Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The news from Ukraine, the news from the Russian Federation, the news from Central Asia all point to conflict zones. I welcome the chairman of Geopolitical Futures, George Friedman, because recently George has written not only about Ukraine and the eve of the diplomatic conversations about Ukraine's fate, but also about my youth, his youth, our youth in America, dating back to the Jack Kennedy administration of 1962, the beginning of the Vietnam conflict. What lessons learned can we use here in the 21st century about the U.S., this large industrial superpower, getting involved in faraway wars against either inferior enemies or enemies that are fighting on home ground? George, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. We both note the fog of war from Kazakhstan right now. And over these next days, we'll learn much more about the turmoil there. The government has resigned. Moscow has to be engaged. What is striking is this is another part of the borderlands that you write about when we come to Ukraine. So before we get involved in borderland talk about the Russian Federation, I want to begin to speak of Vietnam and what the U.S. understood correctly and incorrectly, or incorrectly, as it entered into Vietnam, Operation Mule Train with the U.S. Air Force, Operation Ranch Hand, that's Agent Orange, the Kennedy administration committing the U.S. to the Vietnam catastrophe. Good evening to you, George.
Good evening. How are you?
I am pleased to speak of Vietnam, George. What did we learn from those days?
Well, the most important thing we learned is we can lose a war. The United States, and I used to be taught this in school, said never lost a war. That was not quite true, but it was the belief. We came out of World War II having acted brilliantly, superbly, carefully, meticulously, and we won. And we understood that war, and we believed that all war kind of looked like that. And we discovered in Vietnam that not only does war not look like that, but that we may not be ready for certain wars and can lose them.
The Vietnam War, let us recover what went wrong. The Vietnamese, representing Hanoi, the North Vietnamese, also representing the Viet Cong, the rebellious units in the South that were attached to the Viet Cong. The way it was presented in the United States in the headlines, as you well remember, was that this was part of the domino phenomenon. If we let this country fall, then that will, the inevitable march of communism to take over the planet. Did we understand that correctly at the time? Was it communicated to the public correctly?
Well, it was both true and insufficient. The desire of Vietnam to become a united country, to become a single country, really mattered. And even those who were communists were taken by it. At the same time, it was part of communism, the communist movement around the world. So our response to it, because it was communist, was to act. But we acted without asking the question of precisely what will we do and how will we win. So communism was a concept that was spreading around the world. It was supported by the Soviet Union and communist China. But it did not mean that we could engage everywhere. There are some places better than others. And we simply said, anywhere there's a threat, we will answer. That was what John F. Kennedy promised us, you know, that we will go anywhere, do anything, face any foe. Well, all right. Can we win this one? What does it take? We went back to commanders who were superb in World War II, William Westmoreland, people like that, who now are facing a war they didn't understand, had no preparation for. And so we picked a war that was unlikely to be won. There were lots of other places to fight. We didn't have to fight here.
The industrial superpower of the United States, in FDR's magical phrase, the arsenal of democracy. I learned, George, these random facts you learn late in life, that of those feared Tiger tanks that were dominating the battlefield in all the set pieces of the Second War, the Germans only managed to produce about 1,600 of them, where we produced 49,000 Sherman tanks, 49,000. We are an industrial supergiant. The Vietnamese had no industry to speak of. Did we assume in the 1960s that that would mean we would win because they don't have tanks?
Precisely. But they had a command of the terrain, troops that were well-trained for that terrain, and we were going in with a great deal of equipment designed to kill an enemy we couldn't find because they used that terrain to hide themselves. So whereas in World War II, we were fighting a North European plain, you could see everything out there. You could see where the enemy was. In this war, it was almost impossible to find them. And so we had the ability to win any engagement. And the North Vietnamese made certain we didn't have the engagements we could win.
You write that America made three major mistakes. We've touched on them, but let's go through them formally. What did we expect to happen when Yankee Doodle showed up in Hanoi? Did we have expectations, or was this to be conquest?
We had the expectations we had had in Europe, that they would be delighted to see us, that they didn't want to be dominated by the Soviets, that once we came in, they would rally to the cause. What we discovered was that they didn't particularly trust us after the Vietnamese. They didn't want to fight a war. They could find ways to live within the communist framework. But most important, they were sick of foreigners. They wanted, once again, to have Vietnam for Vietnamese.
The second lesson. There are many, many ways to praise Eisenhower. This is not one of them. The French were colonial masters who returned after the Second War, despite all the talk of decolonization and no more empires and democracy and sovereignty. The French and the British went back in and assumed the role of master that they'd had before the Second War. The Vietnamese hated the French. The French did nothing to make friends. Did Eisenhower know that when he took over the battle after Dien Bien Phu?
He didn't actually take over the battle as much as the retreat. He was, interestingly enough, Eisenhower wanted a small army. When he talked about the military-industrial complex, he was also saying that we shouldn't have a large army. Why? Because if we have a large army, we'd use it. And he looked at Vietnam and said, this is an example of what happens when we promiscuously enter a war. And he wanted to keep the army much smaller. John Kennedy ran against him, saying basically he was weak. You know, he didn't want to have a large force. And that's one of the stories. But Eisenhower took over the dribbling end of this, but he never sent major force in. He didn't want it to do it, and he didn't.
That was Kennedy's decision in 1962. 62 is one of those years that is so rich to plumb, because that's Cuban Missile Crisis later in the year. That's Khrushchev responding to the American basing of missiles in Turkey. Why did Kennedy make the decision to vouchsafe the sending of Air Force and eventually units to guard the Air Force into Vietnam? What was his ambition? Was it political only, or did he have some larger vision?
There were two things driving him. The first was that he was a naval officer in World War II. He accepted the concepts of naval warfare, but more than that, of war in general, which is that industrial power always trumps weakness, industrial weakness. He also was of the generation that saw totalitarianism as an unspeakable evil. His father had been weak on Nazism, on supporting Munich and things like that. What he took away from that was that totalitarian movements must be fought wherever they are, whatever they present themselves. And he looked at communism, not inappropriately, as a totalitarian movement. And if they were operating in this country or that country or the other, we must be there. So the lesson he took out of World War II was the lesson of Munich on the one side, and on the other side, the supremacy of advanced military equipment. And he got us into a war where there was an enemy, but where we might not be able to win.
Kennedy commits. Kennedy is tragically murdered. Lyndon Johnson grows the commitment through the 1960s. Eventually, there were 500,000 American soldiers fighting a shadowy enemy that was underground mostly. And the retreat from Vietnam, first in 72 with Richard Nixon's Vietnamization, and then finally the bug out in 75. The reason George writes about this, I'm presuming, is because there are lessons here for what happened to the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. Did we learn a lesson, George, in those two failures?
Well, I think we have now, but we didn't learn the lesson from Vietnam, which was that an enemy does not have to be armed with artillery when fighting in his own terrain to defeat us. He knows his countryside. He knows his people. He knows where to hide. He knows when to come out. And we are, in many ways, sitting ducks. We saw that in Iraq with the IEDs, the explosives that were being used. For 20 years, we fought in Afghanistan, attempting to dislodge Taliban, so native to Afghanistan, so fundamental to Afghanistan, that it knew every nook and cranny. So the point is that the United States can be the most powerful country in the world, yet not have the ability to win a war in certain specialized environments where we continually go into.
You make the ironic point that the advantage George Washington and the not dominant number of patriots had in 1778, 79 was that they knew the countryside and that they could hide in it, the retreat from outside of New York, and that the large British force that could land anywhere because of the Navy was incapable of running down Washington. So that's a lesson we learned to our advantage in the 18th century. Here we are in the 21st century. Have we learned it now, George? Is it commonplace in Washington? Do not mess with indigenous populations that can hide.
I think we've learned it very well, but there's a problem. There are sometimes issues like Afghanistan come up where we have the statement, something must be done. And the president is sitting there and is hearing that something must be done. And so he does something. He won't be president when it comes to its climax. But our weakness as a people is we see injustice and demand that the United States act and not ask the question, can it act? And frankly, presidents are the creatures of the public. They'll do what demanded.
We turn to the president next. We're going to talk Ukraine and the eve of the conversation between surrogates for Vladimir Putin and Joseph Biden. George Friedman is the chairman of Geopolitical Futures. It's a subscription site I recommend. We turn next to George's essay about Ukraine and what is to be done. Presidents must do something. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.